Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
I'm kind of a sucker for science reporting. When other headlines induce anxiety or uncertainty, there's a kind of pragmatic optimism in learning about new discoveries, especially those that offer hope for people with serious health challenges. So why do many landmark studies ultimately fail to produce results for patients? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. A few years ago, NPR's Richard Harris shifted his journalistic focus from the environment to biomedical research. He's covered lots of big announcements about animal research and new medicines in development, and he's noticed a pattern. Many of the studies announced with great fanfare never pan out in the form of effective treatment for humans. Not only do some big biomedical studies fail to yield new drugs, it turns out lots of them can't even be duplicated by other scientists. Richard Harris's new book is called Rigor Mortis: How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. He joins us this hour from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Richard, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
You spent a long time focusing on environmental science. What's different about the kinds of mistakes in biomedical science that made you want to write a book about it?
Well, interesting question. When I first was asked to go back and look at biomedicine, which I hadn't done for more than a decade, I thought, well, let's take a look and see what's been going on while I haven't been paying that close attention. And what I discovered was the budget for the NIH doubled between 1998 and 2003. So people were hiring new scientists like crazy. Lab space was growing all over the country. And then in 2003, Congress said, okay, enough is enough. We're going to basically hold funding more or less steady, or actually in real terms, the funding started to decline ultimately by about 20% when you think about the purchasing power required just to keep a lab going and personnel and so on. So I realized this was a very dramatic change, and it was clearly going to have some repercussions. And so I set out to figure out what those repercussions might be.
And some of the repercussions have to do with how carefully things are checked after they have been done. What is the importance of duplicating a study that's already been proved conclusive?
Well, nothing is proved conclusive in science. And I should say that biomedical research is a very hard thing to do. You're dealing with living cells, animals, organisms, it's never easy to get a really clear, straight answer the first time around. So when you come up with a result, it's provisional. And the real question, the real test of science is if you can make it work in your lab, somebody else should be able to make it work in their lab if it's a real result and not just a fluke. And so this is a critical part of science. And researchers, therefore, when an exciting discovery comes down the pike, they say, wow, that's really cool. I'm going to see if I can make that happen. And unfortunately, a lot of the times, the answer is no. An exciting result turns out to have been a fluke or some other problem or something unexpected, and the result sort of fizzles away. Now, we as journalists, are very excited to find those first initial flashy results, and we tend to report them and say, hey, look, here's the latest, greatest thing that's coming down the pike. We don't so often learn about the follow-up studies that show that actually didn't pan out the way we thought it did. So I think the public gets this perception that there are all of these, fabulous things happening all the time, and some of the results are true and exciting and are pushing science forward. There's no question about that. But a lot of them fall by the wayside, and we tend not to hear about those stories.
Is it easier to get funding for a groundbreaking hypothesis than for a study that looks to duplicate previous results?
That's absolutely the case. And that's one of the issues here is that studies do the whole pressure on science is to do those flashy initial studies. And the pressure is really on the scientists because their promotions depend upon it. Their ability to get further grants depends upon it. If you want to keep going and saying, hey, I'm hot, you have to keep producing results that are catching attention and so on. There's a lot less really reward for the kinds of studies that, come back and say, okay, let's take a closer look at that. These studies do happen anyway, these confirmatory studies, because if you're working in a lab and your professor comes in and say you're a graduate student or a postdoctoral researcher, the head of the lab comes in and says, oh, here's a really exciting result. I want to build on that in this lab. See if you can make it repeat these experiments. And so a lot of these reproducible experiments do take place, but in a sort of a more casual context. It's not that people are given a huge pile of money up front to reproduce them. But if it's a really exciting study, people do generally turn around and try to see if they can reproduce them.
Something else you noticed is that study results are often described with very hyperbolic language.
Yes, indeed. And the hyperbolic language has been growing in recent years. There was a paper a few years ago that was looking at words like unprecedented and robust, words that appear in the scientific literature. And they found between, I forget the exact dates, but like 1970s up until the early 2000s and beyond, those words were just proliferating like crazy in the biomedical literature. They said it was like 150,000% increase or 15,000% increase, a very large number at any rate, a hyperbolic number as a matter of fact. But the point is that scientists themselves recognize that they really need to show that what they're doing is exciting and unprecedented and robust and all the rest of that stuff. So unfortunately, that creeps into the language of the papers themselves. And then, of course, we in journalism are all too happy to pick up those words as well and relay them on to our audiences.
How are studies reviewed before they're published in academic medical journals?
Well, basically the peer review process is you do some research, you presumably send it off to a journal and hope that they want to publish it. The journal editor will look at it and say, is this an interesting result that we want to publish? And if so, they send it off to a number of anonymous scientists who take a look at it. Now, they don't try to reproduce the experiments. They may not even look that carefully at the statistics you used or the various methods you used. They'll take a look at it. They'll sort of say, does this make sense? Do I believe it? Is it interesting? Is it exciting? They'll send their comments back to the editor, and then the editor gets to weigh all of those peer-reviewed comments and decide, well, do I want to put this paper in my journal? That's kind of the process. And it's the expectation is that peer review catches all sorts of errors, and it does catch some, but it is not a foolproof method by any means to identify studies that are not going to pan out.
I was talking to the autism expert and an animal husbandry expert, Temple Grandin, a couple of weeks ago, and she said that when she's given a paper to review, what she's looking at is how the animals were treated in a study and if it compares with the way other studies have been done. And I was thinking about the fact that different reviewers may bring different filters to what they're looking at before they decide to publish.
That's absolutely true. And one of the most important parts of a review should be to look at how well the statistics are being done, the mathematics and analysis. And very often the papers don't go out to people who are experts on those areas. And so as a result, you can get a paper that has dubious statistics that sails through the peer review process just because they haven't sent it to a biostatistician to pick apart, if you will. And so it really does depend upon the eye of the beholder. And that's a sort of a judgment call made by the journals about, who am I going to send this out to for peer review?
Your book made me think of a question that should have occurred to me long ago, which is, why are rodents the gold standard animal in science labs?
That is an interesting conundrum because, of course, they're mammals like we are, but they've been evolving for tens of millions of years in their own particular direction as we have been evolving in our own direction for tens of millions of years. So even though we share some common bonds as mammals, we are very different organisms. And there are some places where mammals are, mice and rats in particular, are useful for learning some things about human biology. There's absolutely no question about that. And they are particularly useful for trying to understand how a drug or some sort of new substance, whether we have to worry about the toxicity of those drugs. And that's a very important part of animal research. But when scientists sort of say, I want to study a human disease, and this mouse that I've genetically engineered looks somewhat like the disease that it appears in human beings, very often those end up leading to false leads. And so a lot of things that are very exciting in mice, cures for stroke or cancer or all sorts of other diseases that have been cured in mice countless times, that doesn't translate to human beings. And it's really because we're different. And I'm sympathetic with scientists because they often say, well, I don't really have anything better to work with. And mice are not very expensive. They are readily available. Everybody else in their field uses mice, so they can compare their results with what everybody else is doing. So there's sort of cultural reasons why mice and rats have been used so heavily in science. But the result is we should be really cautious about looking at the results of a mouse study and making any statement at all about whether that's going to be useful for human beings.
And it turns out that mice and rats are responsive to their environments in the same way that humans might be, so that the results can vary depending on how they're handled in the lab, may have nothing to do with what's actually being tested.
That's absolutely true. In fact, it even depends whether it's a man or a woman who's handling a mouse. Mice respond very strongly to the sex of their human handler. So that's one thing, whether their bedding is the same or different, whether they're put in a sort of a quiet corner of a laboratory or whether they're upright under the fluorescent lights. So many things are different and vary that it makes it challenging to get results, even comparing from one mouse lab to another mouse lab. Sometimes those don't even translate, and that's for many different reasons.
Richard Harris is my guest. He covers science with an emphasis on biomedical research for NPR. His new book is called Rigor Mortis: How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Taking a quick break from our conversation right now, Stephen Becker has just stepped into the room. We have $74,000 left to raise in order to have completed the spring membership campaign here at KERA.
And Chris, I've actually got a more important number, and that number is 50. And that's the number of KERA listeners we need to hear from during the Think Show today, which is, 2 hours long, as you of course know. And the reason is some very generous friends of the station will contribute an additional $1,000 to KERA when we hear from those 50 listeners. And as if that weren't enough, also, the Texas Instruments Foundation, as part of their employee and retiree gift matching program, will also kick in an additional $1,000. So let me just kind of cull that all the way down. When the station hears from 50 listeners, an extra $2,000 will be generated, and that will go a long way towards taking care of the overall money that we have left to raise during this drive, and we'll be real close to being done.
46 contributions away from receiving that additional $2,000. Here's the thing. If you make a contribution this hour and we make the goal, I think you should take credit for the entire extra $2,000. So let's just say you did 10 bucks a month, right? You can say, I gave $120 to KERA for this year, but I'm responsible for $2,120.
You can all take credit for being the 50th person. and if you need to sweeten that deal, as if that's, that's a great, all of those are great reasons to enter and to go ahead and contribute. But we should let you know, when you contribute during this hour, you are going to be automatically entered in to win that Steve 7-day European city tour. You'll have your choice of visiting Paris, Rome, or London. This is going to be drawn for when the drive wraps up successfully, which we're thinking, might even be as soon as tomorrow. We're hoping for tomorrow. We have $74,000 left to raise. So just in summary, when you contribute this hour, you'll be entered in for the Rick Steves drawing. You will also help the station get closer to receiving an additional $2,000. So I can scarcely think of a better time to contribute.
And you know what? Don't price it yet, because we have thank you gift copies available of Richard Harris's fascinating book, Rigor Mortis. If you work in the biomedical field, you'll definitely be interested. But honestly, if you're just a person who listens to science headlines, who pays attention to what's happening in the news, who maybe has a friend or relative who is hoping for, advancements in medicine, this is a great book to have. Not only does it tell you what's going on, but it gives you a really good insight on how to pay attention to the kind of science reporting that we see out in the world and here, and really just gives you a sense of the way things work. So we'd love to offer a copy of Rigor Mortis when you make a contribution in the amount of $10 a month or more on the sustaining plan, or you can do it all at once with a gift of $120 at 888-694-6931 or at kera.org.
Just 46 people left to hear from between now and 2 p.m. That's going to ensure that KERA receives this additional $2,000, some of it from friends of the station, some of it from the Texas Instruments Foundation and their employee and retiree gift matching program. This is an incredible opportunity for not only KERA, but for you, the listener, because you will be bringing public radio to everybody in North Texas. And hey, you'll also get qualified for this Rick Steves 7-day European city tour. 888-694-6931 or visit us online at kera.org. And thanks.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can pursue their passion. You can study social justice and build activism skills with summer courses like education, equality, and human rights. You can apply now at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with NPR's Richard Harris. His new book is called Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Richard, another complication of doing research with rodent models, rodent subjects, is that some things that might be toxic to them are okay to us. You note that some of the compounds in things like coffee and aspirin probably wouldn't be approved if we were isolating them and running them through a rodent study today.
That's true, but in a general sense, they're not bad for looking at the toxicology of things and whether we should worry about drugs. But they do miss from time to time, and so we have to be always cautious. And in fact, one thing before a drug gets approved, it gets tested in multiple animals, so we're never totally dependent upon a mouse study or a rat study before a drug gets put on the market. But they're not perfectly us. One of my favorite little stories about this was that the development is incredibly popular and widely used drugs, the statin drugs to mm-hmm. control cholesterol, were initially tested in rats and mice, and in fact, they did not work at all. And one of the big drug companies that was developing this drug that could, you know, make a huge difference to human health if you could control cholesterol, they just gave up on these drugs and said, well, I guess that was a dead end. The biology sounded good, but it's obviously not panning out in these animals. But there was a researcher in Japan who said, I'm not ready to give up on this stuff yet. And he went down the hall, and he was working in an adjoining lab with someone who was actually studying various things in chickens, of all things. And he said, could I just try this weird drug, the statin drug, on your chickens and see if it helps them? And lo and behold, this drug that did not work in mice and rats did work in chickens. And that was the beginning of this incredibly widely used and very successful drug to control cholesterol. So every now and then being a little bit more persistent and not just saying, well, if it's not going to work in a rat, it's not going to work in humans, we're going to move on. We were rewarded collectively by the persistence of this one individual scientist.
There are really cool stories throughout the history of science and innovation where somebody working on one problem stumbles on a solution for a different problem altogether. Assuming we want to know if such serendipity has occurred, what are the dangers, Richard, of reclassifying a study according to what it seems to show rather than what it set out to show?
Well, there is a trap here, which is that very often scientists will run an experiment and say, you know, I think maybe this gene is related to cancer X, Y, or Z. And so they'll run an experiment and they don't get the result they're expecting. And they'll say, well, maybe there's something else interesting in this study. And they'll dig around and they say, well, I didn't get the result I was expecting, but there is some other interesting curiosity here. And I'm going to say, aha, that finding, I'll make a new hypothesis at this point. I will hypothesize that this particular phenomenon will be correct. And the problem with that is very often those are false leads. Those are just deceptive things, little flukes that happen in studies. You get a result just by chance. If you're looking at, you know, 20 things and you're testing a bunch of, you know, if you look at enough factors, basically, you just by chance, you're going to stumble across something that actually is a correlation, but is not a real cause and effect thing. So the problem is that scientists often will turn around and take that sort of chance finding and say, aha, I now have a study that demonstrates that this is, you know, here's my new hypothesis and here's evidence that it's true. Those sort of serendipitous moments are very important for science because maybe it is a new lead. But at that point, instead of publishing your result and saying, you know, here's evidence, you should publish this as an exploratory idea and say, wow, if this is true, if I now design a study to test this hypothesis directly, I'll find out whether my original study was a fluke or not. And very often, as I say, they do turn out to be flukes. And there's one source of misleading material in the scientific literature is people aren't really clear about what they were going after in the first place. And then when follow-up studies come along eventually and they look at that hypothesis with a correctly designed study, as I say, very often those turn out not to be true. But we shouldn't throw away those fluke observations. We should just handle them with a great deal of care.
I've done so many interviews on this show with people who urge us to embrace failure and to recognize that there is still something gained when, you know, our hypothesis, for example, turns out to be wrong. That sounds really great, and it's a wonderful way to motivate ourselves, but does failure or a mistaken hypothesis make it hard to get funding for the next thing you want to do?
Well, that is a problem in the long run. I think in the competitive environment right now, hyper-competitive environment of biomedical research, unfortunately, people do have to kind of feel they have to stick with their tried and true ideas, even if they start to be crumbling in their fingers. It's like, well, I don't think this is necessarily working anymore. But on the other hand, it'll be much harder for them to get a grant to try some completely new idea than it will be for them to get another grant to keep chipping away at their hypothesis, even if it seems to be losing steam. So it's a consequence of the fact that that there's just, you know, most grant proposals that get put in don't get approved, maybe less than 20% do. So scientists have to write 5 or 6 grants just to get one idea funded. And it's a very inefficient system, and it's also drives people in a direction and makes them reluctant to give up on ideas that probably they should have given up on. But I also agree with the folks who say, you know, failure is a critical element of science. Absolutely it is. We should be careful to learn from failures. Most experiments don't work, and scientists know that, and it's amazing. They must be the most optimistic people on the planet, because they know most of the time they sit down to try an experiment, it in fact does not work. And so, but that doesn't deter them, because for the ones that do work, those do move science along a lot. And even the ones that don't come out the way they're expected to do, you can still extract meaning from them and still help you understand fresh directions or even, you know, get new ideas. So failure is definitely something that should be embraced. And I don't mean in the book to imply that that all of this is just spawning useless misery. There's certainly meaning to be extracted out of it, but we also have to be careful not to draw too broad conclusions from things that look right but turn out to be wrong.
I was surprised to learn that sometimes scientists run into hurdles because they are not working with the tissue that they thought they were working with. For example, you write about researchers thinking they'd made strides in treatment for breast cancer, but they were dealing with skin cancer samples.
Yeah, that's quite a story. This actually comes out of Houston. In 1976, researchers at the MD Anderson Hospital and Tumor Clinic, I think it was called at the time, isolated some breast cancer tissue from a 31-year-old woman who was there for treatment, and they developed a cell line. The idea is these cells could grow in the laboratory indefinitely, and they were considered a really powerful tool for studying breast cancer. And over the years, it was used in thousands of laboratories. The National Institutes of Health highlighted it as one of sort of the 60 archetypal cells, if you will, sort of the 60 classic cells that the National Cancer Institute uses to help identify, you know, help people focus their studies a little bit. In the year 2000, though, somebody was doing some genetic fingerprinting analysis of these cell lines, and they realized, guess what? This is actually not a breast cancer. It's a melanoma cell that people have been using. And that confusion had happened many years ago, as far as they could tell. And by then, there had been hundreds of studies published on this cell line. And unfortunately, the word didn't really get out. And people kept using that cell line for many years. And in fact, I think if you look in the literature today, you still find examples of this cell line, which is almost certainly a melanoma, being referred to as a breast cancer cell line. And scientists are continuing to use it, not understanding really what tissue they're working with. Now, if you're studying a really broad question about cancer, maybe it doesn't matter so much. But if you actually think you're studying breast cancer, you're just getting misleading results out of that.
I want to make clear that a lot of the scientists you spoke to didn't deny that there are some problems and wanted to be actively involved in solutions. You didn't find people who didn't care about the quality of the science they were doing.
No, that's true. I think that nobody wants to spend their time doing dead-end research, and they don't like to you know, find themselves in that position, and they don't want to think that they're building on research results from other laboratories that are also wrong. Last year, Nature, the journal, did a survey of scientists and said, is there a reproducibility crisis in this country? Or more broadly, is there just a reproducibility crisis in science? And more than half of the respondents said, yes, there's a serious crisis in reproducibility. And another big chunk, more than almost 40 more percent, said there's a slight crisis. I'm not sure exactly what a slight crisis is. But overall, 90% of the people who responded to this to the survey said, yes, there is a reproducibility crisis in science, and we need to deal with it. And yes, in my book, I spend a fair amount of time talking to, seeking out and talking to scientists who are thinking about, how do we make this work? How do we fix this problem? Because there are certainly things that can be done, like for example, just taking simple tests of cell lines to make sure you're working on the cell line you think you're working on. But there are all sorts of, you know, they start with easy technical fixes like that, and then they get more and more complicated. But there's lots of stuff that can be done, and a surprising number of scientists who are thinking, how do we improve this enterprise so that we're all making sure that we have as little failure as possible along the way. You know, some failure is inevitable. It's part and parcel of science, and we should, you know, sort of embrace that and accept that. But there's a lot of failure that we could avoid with a little bit more care and with deeper thought about experimental design and statistical analysis and so on. And that's where the focus, I think, is on a lot of these scientists who are thinking, how can we make the enterprise overall work better?
What are the pros and cons from the perspective of a scientist running a study of sharing data with other labs as opposed to keeping it under wraps?
This is a big one because obviously scientists are very competitive. And on the one hand, if they are worried about being scooped by a competitor, they may want to keep their data under wraps. They don't necessarily want to give anybody a leg up on what they're doing and sort of hold their information close. On the other hand, if they're studying something that is, say, a tissue that's been donated by a patient doesn't, just wants progress on whatever disease that scientist is studying. And if you ask a patient, do you want the scientist that you gave this material to have exclusive access to it? Patients would say, of course not. I want it as widely shared as possible. And so that's one tension. The real advantage of sharing not only the tissues, but also all of the information relative to a study, both the data, the computer code that you wrote to analyze the data, and putting that all out there, is if there is a mistake in what you've done, or if it doesn't quite work out the way you think it did, other scientists can come along and look at that and say, I'm going to reanalyze this, and in short order, I can determine whether it's right or wrong. And so this sort of shortens the cycle of not knowing whether this finding is real or not, and things can progress much more rapidly. I have a favorite story about that, which I talk about in the book, which was in 2001 when the scientists published the draft genome of the human genome, mm-hmm. All 3 billion letters that sort of spell out who we are in the human genome. One of their conclusions was a surprising observation that there were genes directly from bacteria that lived inside our genes in an unexpected way. And this seemed really quite remarkable. They highlighted it in their paper. Another scientist said, I don't believe that at all. And he went back into the literature, and actually not just the literature, but the human genome was made widely available, completely freely available as it was being generated. So all he had to do was go to this big database, and he reanalyzed this information and concluded, guess what? That was a mistaken conclusion. And just in a matter of months, this very exciting discovery was put on the shelf, and people realized, oops, it was just a stumble, and we're not going to spend a lot of time and effort worrying about it anymore. Thanks to the openness of the data, we were able to get a really quick answer, and everybody moved on.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is NPR biomedicine correspondent Richard Harris. He has a new book out called Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. If, like me, you were listening to this conversation and you think I really want to delve into that book, we have an easy way for you to do it as you support KERA today. You can make a contribution at the level of $10 a month or more and choose Rigor Mortis, How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions as your thank you gift. Looking for an additional 34 people to thank this hour in order to stay on track with our goal for Think Today.
And Chris, we have sort of a double challenge, I suppose. We don't get those very often, but this is a big one. So there's a great reason to contribute between now and 2 p.m., and that's because when KERA receives 50 contributions from listeners during Think Today, generous friends of the station will contribute an additional $1,000 to the station. But wait, there's more. Their donation will also be matched by the Texas Instruments Foundation as part of their employee and retiree gift matching program. So that works out to $2,000 coming into KERA when we hear from 50 of you. Now, all you need to worry about is one. And that's, you know, the one person you can control, you. And if you can take just a minute and contribute this hour would be great. You're going to go a long way to making sure that that $2,000 comes into the station. You can do that by visiting us at kera.org or 888-694-6931.
Looking for an additional 31 contributions this hour. We hope that you will be the very next person so that we can make that goal, receive that extra challenge money. KERA is made available to everyone. It's here all the time. The idea is that you try it for a while, you listen, you realize you are absolutely hooked on public radio, and then you decide to become a sustaining member, a sponsoring member of the station. The wonderful thing that exists is the fact that you can set your own membership level. So you might be a person who typically gives thousands of dollars to not-for-profit organizations that you believe in. You can absolutely do that. You know, if $5 or $10 or $20 a month is more in line with your budget, there is absolutely a way to do that as well. We welcome your contribution, and we will make it as simple as possible with that sustaining membership that is set up, and then you can forget it and just know that you are supporting this station. 888-694-6931 is the number. You can go to kera.org. Looks like we are just shy of halfway there. Started the hour with a goal of 50 contributions. We have 26 to go.
Some of the people who have helped us get there are Jenny Hale in Dallas, Carol Flower of DeSoto. Also thanks to Anita Coker of North Richland Hills, Peggy Lacey of Dallas, and Kim Allen in Justin, who says that she starts a lot of her conversations with her family and friends by, "I heard this on KERA, dot, dot, dot." Well, you are in great company, Kim, because I think a lot of people start conversations with their family and friends about stuff that they hear on KERA here every day. And it's because for so many people, KERA is really your window into the world. You know, you find out about what's going on. You have context about the news from listening to not only the Think Show, but All Things Considered and Morning Edition, Fresh Air, which will be coming up here in a little bit today. If you're one of those people who is constantly referencing things that you heard here on the station, well, it's important that we hear from you. You can contribute at 888-694-6931 or, of course, online at kera.org.
Your contribution goes right to work for you and for your community. KERA is a community-owned and operated resource. We are available here in North Texas. We are available elsewhere through the podcast and the online streaming service, but mostly we are here for you in this community, and we ask for your support. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make a contribution online at kera.org. Check out the full range of thank you gifts, and there is a great assortment. But please take action now in support of your public radio station. Back in 2 minutes with Richard Harris. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for working adults interested in human-centered leadership. You can take courses this fall like Personhood in the Age of Corporate Enterprise. You can apply now at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with NPR science reporter Richard Harris, whose new book is called Rigor Mortis: How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Richard, deliberate fraud in biomedical research is not unheard of, but it is rare. Far more common is the problem of unintentional bias. How does that happen?
Right. Yeah. The what happens is there are many, many ways to fool yourself. And the whole idea of science actually is to make sure you're not fooling yourself and not seeing what you want to see and what you think you expect to see. And so there are many, many kinds of bias. And that's and if you're applying every single rule exactly, you still may not get it exactly right. Some bias can creep in. And the result is that things that turn out to be wrong, for quite a while people can still hold on to as an idea and not realize, because they're so excited, they're so expecting to see what they're seeing, that it sometimes can take a very dramatically different approach to a problem before people realize that something is wrong. And this is human nature. This is nothing about science, except science tries to, as much as possible, put in controls to adapt to human nature and to try to make this as small a problem as possible. But, you know, this does happen, and it is... I have a story in the book about a discovery that was made around 1999, the year 2000, where people thought that they could take just cells out of bone marrow and turn them into any other kind of cell that you could imagine. Yeah. And there were hundreds and hundreds of studies done that were purporting to show that result, because everyone thought this is such a great advance. This would be so useful as a laboratory tool, and people just went to town on it. Finally, several years later, somebody at Stanford realized that, you know, no one has ever really done the real careful study to see, was that initial study actually true? And when they did super careful experiments, they realized, you know, there was some misunderstanding about how to interpret the results. And in fact, this was not happening at all. But by then, a lot of people had gone off to the races on this and thought that they had something very exciting. So sometimes bias can take a while to work itself out. Somebody really needs to have that, bring in that really skeptical eye. And that was the story with that particular discovery.
All right, let's jump on the phones here at 800-933-5372. Alex is on the line from Dallas. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I'm just wondering if we are maybe in a moment in our culture where, you know, you have something like the March for Science, which took place recently, where criticism or questioning of science is sort of discouraged, or, you know, there's pressure not to do that, or it's even shamed. I'm wondering if you think there's a danger there. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I think that to the credit of the people who run the National Institutes of Health, they, as this cropped up as a problem some years ago, they recognized that this was a serious issue, and they were not going to pretend otherwise. The director, Francis Collins, stood up in front of Congress and said, yes, this is a serious issue. I'm not going to sweep it under the rug, essentially. He didn't use exactly those words, but that was the message. And in fact, they've been working really hard to try to correct these problems and address them, because it doesn't do anyone any good to pretend that these aren't problems, even though this is an awkward time in the funding of science. There's no question about that. But people are still determined to say, look, we recognize this as a problem. We've got to deal with it. And there may be, they're prepared for some pushback. But on the other hand, the reality is everyone wants science to work better. And ignoring these problems and hoping, you know, that they just go away is not a viable way forward. So, yeah, it's a good question. But I think that to the credit of the people at the NIH and elsewhere, I think people are recognizing, no, we have to confront this face on, acknowledge it, deal with it, find solutions, and improve science.
Would it be helpful or harmful to somehow punish flawed results that are the result of sloppy science?
Well, I think if it's the result of fraud or misconduct, those should definitely be punished. And I think sometimes those punishments end up being fairly light, and people are not necessarily even banned from science for life and so on. And I think there could be some teeth in those rare occurrences where it's actually misconduct that's behind it. I think a lot of the other time, though, it's people just, you know, it's not the same people making the same errors all the time. This is something that can creep into any lab. In fact, I interviewed a Nobel laureate who admitted it early in her career, or acknowledged early in her career, that she had published a very exciting result that turned out to be wrong. And it was, she says, it was a case of just the publication pressure, that it was, you know, she heard, you know, hoofbeats behind her. There was competition coming up, and she had to put out what she had, and she knew it wasn't as good and strong a study as ultimately she really wanted, but she sort of took the chance, and it didn't pan out. So you certainly wouldn't want to squeeze out brilliant scientists like that from science. And the real problem is that it's not easy to identify just sort of the bad apples. It's not even the right way to think about it.
We have an email here from Don who says, in bioengineering, new equipment is typically submitted to a nationally recognized test to determine if the claims made about the functionality of the equipment are true. Perhaps a nationally recognized entity such as the NIH could establish a similar bioscience reference testing lab. What do you think, Richard?
Well, there's so many tests out there that I think it would be an impossible task. If you look at, for example, one of the most powerful tools being used in biomedical research are antibodies, which are proteins that basically recognize supposedly just one particular element in the cell. And so if you're looking for, you know, protein X, you get the antibody that recognizes protein X. But there are 500,000 of those antibodies and all of a very wide variety of qualities that are available for sale to scientists. So the idea of validating those it's just a daunting task. Some of the companies that produce these antibodies are stepping up their efforts to really make sure that their ingredients are performing the way they expect them to. But, just looking at the huge catalog of just antibodies alone, and this is just one small or one class of ingredients, that would be really tough.
What does all this mean, Richard, for people who are perhaps invited to take part in a clinical trial because they have a condition that isn't responding to other known medications?
Well, I'll say a couple of things about that, one of which is that clinical trials actually were suffering remarkably similar problems to this in the 1990s. And there was a lot of sloppy clinical trials going on. And at the time, scientists recognized this is a problem and they fixed the problem. And so that actually gives me hope that that some of these experiments that I'm talking about, these are laboratory experiments before the clinical trial stage comes around. That tells me, that there is clearly a pattern, an example that people can follow to find ways to improve the situation. So that's a hopeful thing. The other thing about clinical trials is that many of the things that get tried, most things get tried in clinical trials do not work. And the expectation should be that you're doing something, you're volunteering for a clinical trial because you're there to advance science. And you recognize that the chances are it's not going to help you, but people will still learn from that information. So, and again, I think rarely do clinical trials endanger people. That happens very occasionally. You're probably not putting your life on the line to be in a clinical trial, but you may very well be testing a drug that is not going to work. And the underpinning science turned out to be not that strong, or it may have looked really good even in some of these early studies, and it just doesn't work in humans for one reason or another. So I think it's a matter of getting the expectations right, that this is not something that's likely to help you, but is something that will help the progress of science.
Okay, what are the lessons here for how journalists should report on new developments and how those of us in the general public should interpret that reporting?
Well, interestingly, I think the general public has figured this out in a certain class of medical reporting. Like, is coffee good for you or bad for you? Well, depends if it's Tuesday or Thursday or next week or whatever. We by now know that studies like that, that everybody knows that some study that sort of purports to give you some answer like that is almost certainly going to be overturned, and we will be sort of in a long period of confusion over what the right answer is. And that's clearly true in a lot of nutrition research. And I think people should maybe take some of that same degree of skepticism to some of the medical studies that come out. I think journalists should be a little bit more cautious about saying overinterpreting results, particularly results from animals, because they so rarely do actually translate into human results. But I think if we just sort of say, accept that, a lot of interesting ideas come out. A lot of them turn out to be wrong. So just don't bet too heavily on any particular idea, either as a journalist pushing it too heavily or as a consumer of news expecting too much of that to turn out to be true in the long run. Science is progressing. I mean, things are moving forward. We just have to recognize that it doesn't happen in a nice, neat, linear fashion. It's two steps forward, one step back, or maybe even two steps back sometimes. We shouldn't be too discouraged about the whole enterprise, but we should also be cautious about not taking literally any given result.
Richard Harris covers science with an emphasis on biomedical research for NPR. His new book is called Rigor Mortis: How Sloppy Science Creates Worthless Cures, Crushes Hope, and Wastes Billions. Richard, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you, Chris. It was great talking to you.
We want to thank all of you listening today. We especially want to thank 32 of you who have made contributions of financial support to KERA just this hour. We started with a goal of 50 contributions. We have 18 to go. We have raised about $6,000 since noon today, and we are looking to continue to gain because we want to finish up this fundraising campaign and serve you full time with the programming that you love. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. Give at the level of $10 a month or more, and we would be delighted to send you a copy of Rigor Mortis. It's a not appetizing title for a very, very interesting book by Richard Harris. I, of course, am not a scientist, and I found everything was beautifully explained so that I could understand it with just sort of an undergraduate understanding of the topics that he's going into. So if you are interested in these kinds of things, this is a good nerd's beach read, I think. So I say that with all the affection in the world. It's a really interesting book.
Science for non-science majors.
Right.
Well, Chris, we are chipping away at that challenge that we have during the Think Show today. We have just 18 listeners left to hear from. And the reason we're talking about this challenge is because some generous friends of the station will contribute an additional $1,000 to KERA when we hear from 50 listeners. Now, we're really close to, you know, hearing from all 50 of those folks, but we have to hear from all 50. It can't just be 49. You know, this is not like horseshoes where close enough counts. You know, it's got to be 50 on the dot. But also, in addition to that $1,000 from the Friends of the Station, that money will be matched by Texas Instruments Foundation as part of the Employee and Retiree Gift Matching Program. So in a nutshell, 50 contributions equals an additional $2,000 into the station. You guys are doing great, making great progress. Just 17 more left to hit that challenge, and that's going to be $2,000 more in the door here at KERA.
We really don't want to walk away from that additional $2,000 for KERA, and you can make it possible. You may not have realized that you are one of the final 17 that we are counting on in this hour to make our goal. You may have thought it was everybody else out there and that we, you know, you were sort of whistling and looking in the other direction, but in fact, we are speaking directly to you. We know you love the station. We know you like the show. So this is a perfect time to make a gift of financial support. And you can find out just how easy it is. And when you do a sustaining membership, how affordable it is to be a supporting member of KERA, a benefactor of quality journalism, news, and information.
We've heard from James Casabar of Bedford, Ray Rutherford of Aledo, and Carolyn Caning of Grapevine, who says that she learned so much from listening to KERA. That's great to hear. We've also heard from, let's see here, Donald Pustel of Grand Prairie and Melon West of Dallas, who says that she loves listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and Intelligent Squared. Also from William Mitchell of Hillsboro. Thanks to all of those folks who have contributed during this hour. They're getting us closer to making sure we reach that goal. And, oh, by the way, all of those people who we just mentioned are going to be entered in to win the big grand prize drawing for this drive, which is a 7-day European city tour through Rick Steves. You're going to have your choice of visiting Paris, Rome, or London. This drawing is going to be drawn for at the end of the conclusion, you know, when this drive is successfully wrapped up. Someone who contributes today might be the person who walks away with that gift.
We would love it if that person were you when you call 888-694-6931 and get signed up. You can also go to kera.org. Not going to lie to you here, this is a fundraiser. When we talk about thank you gifts, they are gifts that we buy to give you to entice you. But most of you don't need the gift itself. Most of you are doing this not for the little thank you gift, but because you believe in public radio, because you look around at the media environment that exists today and you say, listen, there's one thing that I really trust and want to support and encourage, and it happens to be my public radio station, KERA. If you are in that group, we need to hear from you. We have 16 calls in order to make the goal for this hour, for the noon hour, and your contribution will allow us to get an additional $2,000 in challenges from people who believe in this station. Please give your money and know that you're bringing KERA the possibility of getting an additional $2,000.
Also, thanks to Eve and Ali Motamed of Euless and Olivia Reese of Louisville and Katherine Dungy of Fort Worth. Thank you to all of you who have contributed so far during this drive. That drawing is going to take place as soon as the drive is over for that Rick Steves vacation. And just to let you know, anybody who's contributed during this drive, you are automatically entered. But it'd be great to hear from the rest of you who have not contributed just yet. We're going to continue this challenge through the next hour here of Think. So as long as we can hear from you between now and 2 p.m., that would be wonderful.
Sooner rather than later is always great. Thanks.